bubbliness and chatty gratitude, beating away the caterer's suspicions, if he had any, with a flurry of talk that wasn't so much small as microscopic. "I've been at that mechanic 3 times in a year, if you can believe that," she burbled. "The one with the sign outside? They did my friend Carlson's Camry when he got rear-ended by some hick from Kentucky. It was really too bad, 'cause the car had to be completely repainted, and the body shop couldn't match the blue exactly. It was like a teal kind of color, with a bit of turquoise. Capri blue, they called it. That's an island near Italy. Or Greece, maybe. I'm not sure. I've never been to Europe. Have you?"
"No," he said, which Tamika thought was interesting.
"How come you don't cook for the other residents? Just these two?"
"Different contract."
"But you deliver to other people at other places, too?"
"Yes."
"How come you don't just deliver to one place, but, you know, feed everyone there?"
He was getting annoyed now.
"Not everyone can afford what I make," he said. "Now, if you don't mind, I need to concentrate."
And that was that. Tamika tried a few questions that weren't as leading, but the driver gave her nothing more than grunts and monosyllabic replies, his eyes on the road. But he was bored rather than suspicious, and she'd take that. As they pulled up to the Hollows, Tamika dropped her face to her purse and began fiddling with her compact conspicuously. It was the same guard on duty who had turned her away before. Tamika's heart raced. She had used deception to investigate stories before, but this felt different and entirely more dangerous. Newman lowered his window and took a clipboard from the guard with a nod of greeting. As he signed, Tamika kept her face down, saying nothing. Then the window closed, and they were moving. She waited until the gate receded in the side-view mirror before looking up. The house they were approaching was a sprawling mansion, windows set in olive-colored stone, stained with age, though the result looked stately rather than dilapidated. The van rumbled on the gravel approach, swung around the front, and slowed into a parking lot screened from the house by trimmed shrubs and a picket of tight conifers. Newman slid out, muttering, "Give me a hand with the food, will you?" without pausing to hear her response. He dragged the back doors of the van open, pulled out a ramp, and released the clamps on a pair of hostess trolleys with racks of covered dishes. "Take one of these to the kitchen," he said. Tamika didn't object as she moved towards the back door, shoving the trolley's reluctant casters across the gravel with difficulty. The door was locked. She was further dismayed to see a keypad with a red light next to the handle. She could sense Newman behind her, watching. She tapped a series of random numbers into the keypad and tried the door, feigning puzzlement when it didn't open. "Huh," she said, trying the numbers again. "That's weird." Newman sighed, stomped across the gravel, and reached past her irritably to the keypad. "There," he said, as the light turned green. "Sorry," said Tamika, trying to look embarrassed. "I don't usually use this door."
"Well, excuse me for bringing you to the tradesman's entrance," snapped Newman.
"Sorry," said Tamika, meaning it this time. "I didn't mean—"
"It's fine. Just get that food inside, please."
She did so, pushing the trolley down a carpeted hallway flanked by doors, trying to guess which one was the kitchen.
"There," said Newman, sensing her uncertainty, and nodding towards one of the doors on the right.
"Jesus!"
She managed not to turn on him, resolving to stay in character another minute or two. She gave him an inquiring look as he pushed past her to the end of the kitchen, where she saw a large commercial refrigerator. She dithered, checking her watch as if there was somewhere she needed to be, and he gave up.
"Go," he said, loading the fridge. "Do whatever it is you do."
She thanked him for the ride, but he just grunted. In the hallway, she faced the same uncertainty, unclear where she was going or what she was trying to accomplish. She didn't think the guard at the gate had noticed her, but she couldn't be sure. If he'd decided to let her in, only to corner her until law enforcement arrived, she wouldn't have long. She moved down the hallway, listening for sounds beyond the clatter of Newman in the kitchen. She thought she caught a strain of music coming from a door at the far end of the corridor,
Old-fashioned music. Big band. Pre-swing. She tried the door. It opened onto a kind of conservatory, filled with lounge chairs, low tables, and French windows, looking out onto a well-manicured garden surrounded by high hedges. Half a dozen people sat around the room, some sleeping, two drinking coffee and chatting, one playing half a game of chess, and one, the only woman, sitting alone with a book in her hands. All were old as Jersey, possibly older. One of the men was asleep in a wheelchair. It was eerily quiet, and yet no one noticed her entrance. The old woman was not turning the pages of her book, her gaze fixed on a point in space at a middle distance, as if she were seeing nothing at all. Tamika made for her, trying to recall the one female name on the list she'd given Marvin.
"Hi," she said, smiling. "Katerina, right?"
The old woman started, then sat back while her eyes focused.
"Who are you?"
she demanded. There was an hauteur in her manner. Her eyes looked pink and swollen.
"I'm Ashley," Tamika said. "I've come from New York."
"New York?" said the woman. "What are you doing here?"
"Good question," Tamika thought.
"I'm trying to find a friend of mine," she said, improvising. "Jersey Stern. You didn't know him, did you?"
"I know him," she said, but warily. Tamika glanced around the room. Only the chess players seemed to be paying her any attention.
"Do you mind if I sit with you for a moment?" she asked. "It's a free country," said the elderly woman, adjusting her shawl. "Or so we like to think."
Tamika sat and leaned in. The woman smelled like lavender.
"What is this place?" she began, trying to make the question sound casual, an icebreaker.
"Death's waiting room," said the woman. "There used to be twice as many of us as there are now."
"And who are you all?" Tamika ventured.
"Someone could walk in at any minute."
"And these others," she added, producing the list of names she had written down. "Where are they? What connects you?"
The old woman's eyes tightened shrewdly.
"I don't think I should be talking to you," she said. "Are you supposed to be here?"
Another reckless chance.
"No," said Tamika. "I'm not." "Then you should probably go, while you still can."
It wasn't a threat, more like a warning. Her manner was weary and sad.
"You were a friend of Jersey's, weren't you?" said Tamika.
Katerina's eyelids flickered, and she turned momentarily away. When she looked back, her eyes were bright, but when she opened her mouth to speak, her jaw quivered so that she shut it hurriedly and gave a single nod instead.
"I thought so," said Tamika, kindly. "Are you," the old woman managed, "a friend of Jersey's, I mean?"
"Yes," said Tamika, with sudden certainty.
"He entrusted me with something he wanted me to do. But it's about the past, and there's a lot I don't understand."
Katerina nodded again, slowly, thoughtfully.
"We can't talk about that," she said, with a wistful smile, adding in a conspiratorial whisper, "against the rules."
"Right," said Tamika. "I see.
Tell me about Jersey."
She smiled then, a sudden unexpected smile, like clouds parting over a meadow of wildflowers.
"He was a beautiful boy," she said, "long ago, before we came here. I could look into his eyes for hours, even now."
She faltered, and Tamika felt an unexpected panic, a fearful wave of grief rushing in on her heart as she took in the woman's face, the depth of feeling in her bloodshot eyes.
"You've known him a long time," said Tamika.
Katerina nodded.
"He's gone, isn't he?" she said. "Dead. They said he was just going away for a while. But I knew. I felt it."
Tamika looked down, humbled by the old woman's grief.
"I'm so sorry," she breathed.
Katerina Lundegrass clenched her teeth together and patted Tamika's hand with her own, as if it were the younger woman who needed comforting.
"Who are you all?" Tamika asked again. "The best-fed inmates on the continent," said the older woman, wiping her eyes. "You are prisoners here?" Tamika said, wondering if the woman was entirely in her right mind.
Dion's grandmother had developed a dementia that manifested as a persecution complex.
"Jersey said so. He said it looked like a resort, so we would forget we couldn't leave."
"Why not?" Katerina leaned in suddenly so that her face was inches from Tamika's.
"Some things are best kept in the shadows," she said. "People think they want to know everything these days, but they don't. They really don't. So we stay here."
"Who's we?"
Katerina glanced around the room, her eyes lingering on each of the old men in turn.
"Paper people," she said, "hidden away in a drawer where no one can read us."
The phrase raised the hair on the back of Tamika's neck, and somewhere deep in the dark parts of her memory, something chimed, though she could not say what. She brushed her unease aside.
"What line of work were you in, Katerina?"
"I can't tell you that."
"Jersey did. He gave me a book."
The old woman looked at her, and Tamika felt she'd overplayed her hand.
"I think you should go," said Katerina. "Just tell me a little more about—"
"No,"
she responded forcefully. "I mean it. I really think you should go."
She nodded towards the French doors, where two men in suits and overcoats were approaching the house from across the lawn. Tamika got unsteadily to her feet.
"I could give you my phone number," she began.
But the old woman shook her head vigorously.
"Go."
"Thank you,"
said Tamika, taking her hand on impulse and squeezing it gently, feeling the paper-thin softness of the other woman's skin, the bones and raised veins.
"We have an outing tomorrow," said the old woman,
apparently changing her mind.
"Locust Lake State Park. There's a little Presbyterian church just off the road as you drive north from town. Be there at 11.
For a moment, Tamika stared at her, taken aback. But then Katerina was brushing her away. The two men had almost reached the house. She slipped out the way she'd come in, back down the hallway toward the kitchen, then out the door into the gravel lot. But instead of walking back along the drive to the main gate, she cut right, forcing her way through the tight conifers and out onto a concrete path skirting a golf course. She broke into an unsteady run, keeping to the tree line and moving away from the building and into the woods out of bounds from the fairway. She heard a door slam back at the house and the sound of raised voices, male. She took a few more hurried steps into the densest part of the underbrush and dropped to the cold, damp earth and the partial cover of a wild, shapeless magnolia. Another shout, and now the sounds of men running her way. She burrowed a little into the leaf litter, trying to blot out any of her clothing's bright colors that might give her away. She forced herself to keep very still. A guard came down the cart path at a full run, his jacket open, so she could see how his pistol holster swung at his hip. He was white, 30-something, athletic. He wore an earpiece, and his eyes surveyed the woods as he ran. He was also closer than she'd realized. Before his gaze could fall on her, she turned her face down and held her breath, conscious of how her heart was hammering. Her right leg was twisted. What had been merely awkward was getting painful, but she did not dare adjust her position.
"No,"
said the man. For a split second, she thought he was talking to her, and nearly looked up. But then he added,
"I'm going to track round to the third hole and cut east."
He was talking to a colleague through the wireless mic he wore in his ear. She tried to remember if she had seen a hole number on the fairway, in the hope that she could figure out which way he was heading. But her memory was blank. Hole one? Wouldn't it make sense to have the first hole by the house? She thought so, but she knew nothing about golf, so that could be wrong.
Yes.
After a long silence, he was running again, and Tamika could breathe. She waited, still forcing herself not to move, counting in silence until she reached 50, before, with agonizing slowness, she looked up. The path was clear. But coming silently across the dewy grass of the golf course, looking directly at her, was another man, also suited, his right hand pressed to his ear, mouth moving. He had seen her.
18. Jersey, Poland, January 1945.
Mrs. Harpenicht did not refer to my proposed sabotage for 2 whole days, so I began to think she had forgotten about it. The village was full of the evidence of the Nazi retreat, a chaos of men and machines and ransacked shops. You could hear the vehicle engines running all night, and the normally rigid blackout got a little more relaxed. I don't know how much of a factor that was, but on the third night, the bombers found us. The village had been largely spared by the Allied air raids, except for a few planes that, for whatever reason, released their bombs on the south side of the mountains, perhaps to lighten their load as the German fighters closed in. It took us a moment to realize what was happening when we heard the drone of the Lancasters overhead, just distinguishable above the noise of the hasty loading of trucks and half-tracks on the ground. Then the bombs started, producing great roaring flashes that lit the night.
"Will they destroy the mines?"
I whispered to Mrs. Habernicht, as we crouched in the dusty, damp space under the stairs, which passed for a cellar. The old woman listened and shook her head.
"Too deep," she said. "Too many layers of rock. But I don't think they are trying to hit the underground factory. They probably don't even know for certain that it's there."
"Then what?"
"The railway lines and the bridge," she said.
And so it proved. There was enough confusion that I could risk a walk into the village proper, just as the sun came up. A few houses had been hit, and a concrete bunker housing an anti-tank gun, but most of the damage was clustered around the railway station. Several warehouses had burned and collapsed. But the biggest problem for the Germans would be the railroad tracks, which had suffered at least 2 direct hits close to the station. The tracks just stopped on either side of the craters, their rails blackened and twisted. In one place, a hopper wagon had been lifted clean off the rails by the blast and lay in splinters and mangled strips of metal 20 yards away. Whatever was being hauled from the mine would not be going back to Berlin that way, and if the Nazis repaired the tracks, they would only be bombed again. I remembered the concrete strip where the woods had been cleared, the place where I had seen Ungerleader. I had often thought about the work detail I had seen there, and was sure they had been building a rudimentary airfield. The Luftwaffe might be bringing in fighters, but I had seen very few German planes in the last few months, and Mrs. Habernicht said that according to Mr. Starek, who ran the corner shop and who had friends in Warsaw, the Allies could fly wherever they wanted now. That meant that the airstrip, which seemed far longer than anything fighters would need, was for cargo planes, big ones. I wondered if the Polish army or the resistance knew about it. That evening, over supper, I told Mrs. Habernicht what I had seen, and she watched me with that shrewd, thoughtful way of hers, so I fell silent, self-conscious, while I waited for her to speak.
2 new tanks came to the village 2 days ago, she said. I don't know where they came from. Maybe they have been hidden away for a long time, waiting to be used. They are not usual tanks with a single big gun on top. They have a kind of box with 4 guns all firing the same direction, bigger than machine guns, anti-aircraft guns. She said it conversationally, dipping her bread in her soup. People saw them, she added, but by morning they had gone.
Mr. Starrick says they are no good for shooting at the bombers, because they fly too high.
I thought furiously. Ishmael and I had once been enthusiastic readers about military hardware, in the first weeks of the war. That was a long time ago now, a former life. But I had always paid attention to the equipment I had seen and heard of, and I knew that the British had taken to sending single flyers to patrol over German airfields. They would swoop in and attack aircraft during takeoff and landing, when they were most vulnerable. If the Germans were positioning Flakpanzers, which is surely what Mrs. Habernicht had described, then they were looking to protect cargo planes from air attack. "When will the Polish army be here?" I asked. I seemed to be asking that question every day. "Soon," said Mrs. Habernicht, which is what she always said. "And the Russians?" "It will be too late," I said. "The mines are full of new weapons. I am sure of it. If the Nazis can move them somewhere else, the war will go on and on. Perhaps it will never end." I felt the passion rise in my voice, but had to look away. It was the memory of Ishmael. I could not bear to think that all we had gone through was for nothing. "I will speak to Mr. Starrick," said Mrs. Habernicht. I stared at her. "What good will that do?" I demanded, angry now. She said nothing, holding my eyes for a long moment. "Wash your bowl before you get ready for bed," she said. And I understood. Starrick, the shopkeeper, worked for the resistance. He knew people. That night, I was too excited to sleep. I heard the planes as they came in. It was quite different from the Allied raid that had been far away until the bombs dropped, when I felt no danger. This night, the sounds of the aircraft engines caused the hairs on the back of my neck to rise. The planes were big and close, getting louder and lower in pitch as they descended. I got up from my bed and dressed hurriedly. I was barely down the stairs before there was a knock at the door. Mrs. Habernicht opened it in her nightgown and shawl, motioning me into the kitchen, and I listened to muffled voices, heard the front door click shut, and then she was back with the shopkeeper from the corner and another man I did not recognize. He carried a Russian-made submachine gun. They all looked at me. "You want me to lead you to the airfield?" I said. They looked at each other. "Can you?" said Mr. Starrick. "This way," I said. I had only been there once. The night was heavily overcast, so that the darkness in the woods was almost total. But I found my way without undue difficulty. Once we had left the village, the man with the submachine gun made us wait under an oak tree while he went back the way we had come. We spent about 10 minutes alone, just me, Mr. Starrick, and Mrs. Habernicht. The silence broken only when the shopkeeper remarked that it was starting to rain. Mrs. Habernicht said nothing, but squeezed my shoulder encouragingly. I was not scared. Not yet. The gunman returned, bringing three others with him, two men and a woman. One had a rifle, the others had pistols, and the two men bore between them a crate with rope handles. They did not speak to me, though the woman, she must have been no more than 22 or 23, gave me a long appraising look, as if she had expected someone older. "Okay," said the man with the submachine gun, nodding to me. I began walking, my feet finding the trails I had paced for days without having to think about it. We passed the log where I had slept, crossed a shallow stream in which the heavy raindrops were pattering through the leaves above, and eventually climbed a steep escarpment to a fence where the tree canopy opened to the sky. Even in the low light, you could sense the clearing, and as I crawled cautiously up to the lip, just inside the tree line, I felt the soft forest floor grow hard and cluttered with the scree of concrete and stone chippings. There were lights out there. They were hooded, but you could see them when they moved. Men walking about, but other things too.
vehicles. Somewhere among them were those Flakpanzers, with 4 20-millimeter cannons that could tear up ground targets better than they could aircraft. I ducked back into the deep shade of the trees. Two of the resistance men had opened the crate, and one of them was using a hand-cranked radio set to send coordinates from a map he was studying with a small hooded flashlight.
"Now what?" said Mr. Starek.
We were all speaking in Polish.
"We wait," said the man with the submachine gun. "Mrs. Harbenicht, you should take the boy home." "No," I said. "I'm staying."
Again, the woman gave me a long look.
"Very well," he agreed. "But stay out of the way, and keep down."
I peered into the crate. The contents were wrapped in oilcloth. But sitting on the top was a black, heavy-looking revolver.
"Don't even think about it," said the younger woman.
"I didn't say anything," I said.
"You were about to."
"I wasn't," I protested.
"You want the gun."
"So?
Why shouldn't I?"
"You were a child," she said dismissively, fishing a cigarette from the pack in her coat pocket.
"I'm not," I said,
biting down on the fury in my voice, so that for a second she stared, then shrugged.
"You need to learn how to use a gun before you get to carry one," she remarked,
striking a match and cupping its flame against the rain with her fingers as she lit the cigarette.
"And you need to earn the right to use it."
There was a momentary pause.
"That he has," said Mrs. Habernicht.
The younger woman gave her a long, level look through the smoke of her cigarette, then shrugged again.
"No skin off my nose," she said, reaching into the crate. "You don't shoot until I tell you. Got it?"
I nodded.
"What?"
she demanded.
"Yes, ma'am," I said. "I won't shoot until you tell me to."
She hefted the pistol at me, and I took it, awed and dismayed by how heavy it was, though I tried not to show it.
"Six shots," she said. "Make them count."
I nodded, and she managed a bleak grin.
"What's your name, little soldier?"
I bridled at her condescension, but said,
"Jersey."
"I am Maxine," she said. "This is Pierre, Franco, and Roberto." The last was the submachine gunner, who seemed to be in charge. The others all nodded at me. The names were all fake, of course, so no one minded that she had told them. These people were all Poles. Maxine had a Warsaw accent, but I thought Roberto sounded more local. I just nodded and turned away, not looking at the gun, which felt like something strange and magical at my side. It terrified me. Roberto had been peering over the rise, watching the comings and goings at the airstrip. I turned to look at him, just as the blackness behind him shifted suddenly. From where I was, I could see stanchions and tree trunks, pale and hard against the blackness of the night. Floodlights had been turned on. Everyone but Mrs. Habernicht moved closely up the rise and gazed out toward the airstrip. The lights were dazzling, lighting only a portion of the concrete runway. The rest was marked with green lanterns, arrowing into the darkness, straight and precise. The end to our right, where the lights were hard and bluish, showed clusters of trucks and people and equipment. Beyond them, one behind the other, their wings so vast that they almost reached the tree line on either side of the runway, were three of the largest aircraft I had ever seen. They were vast, boxy planes, with wings mounted high atop the fuselage, with six propeller engines, three on each side, which, as I watched, had just begun to turn with a distinctive rising howl. Their fuselages ran low to the ground, and their front ends were open like the jaws of a hippo. Some kind of truck drove right inside, through the nose of one of the planes, and was swallowed.
"What are they?" I gasped.
"Messerschmitt 323 Gigants," said Maxine. "They're in short supply.
Whatever came out of those mines must be important to the Nazis. And they're loaded to go, said the man she had called Franco, who spoke Polish, but didn't sound Polish at all. They are closing their loading ramps. They're not going to leave the runway lit up like a Christmas tree for long. Not with the Allies this close. We need to move. Now. We are supposed to wait for armed support, said Roberto, not happy about it. They should be here by now. Well, they aren't, said Franco, and those planes are ready to go. And what are we supposed to do to stop them? Demanded Maxine. There are six of us. Seven, I said. They ignored me. Suddenly, we heard the roar of a vehicle coming our way along the runway. It was one of the Flakpanzers, essentially a tank with a pulpit-like box on the top, bristling with anti-aircraft cannon.
Wirbelwind, muttered Roberto,
as it rumbled by and took up a position in the darkness at the end of the runway. In English, this would be whirlwind.
The other will be near where the planes are, said Pierre. Get caught between them, and they'll cut us to pieces before we fire a shot.
Roberto seemed to think for a second, then, with an air of decision, flung back a tarp covering the contents of the crate. Beneath it were three metal tubes with bulbous tips, like sink plungers. Panzerfaust, handheld anti-tank weapons.
Where did you get those? I asked.
One of our cells hit a retreating convoy 3 nights ago, said Roberto, lifting one out and handing it to Franco.
Range is about 60 yards. The safety is here. Aim and squeeze here to fire. One shot only. Our priority is the Messerschmitts. We wait as long as we can for the Polish army. I don't want to lose people now.
But the army didn't come. We waited. But the only activity came from the Germans, as they finished loading and readying the aircraft. For 10 long minutes, we said nothing. Roberto checked his watch 6 times. Pierre monitored the radio, but no one called. I found myself torn between the desire to do something and the dread of the attempt. Apart from the Flakpanzers, there was an armored car, a half-track, and a detachment of about 20 guards armed with rifles and submachine guns. We couldn't possibly hope to take them on. I began to dread the arrival of the Polish forces, which might force our hand. And I couldn't help thinking that with only enough firepower to destroy the planes and not the Flakpanzers, we couldn't hope to survive the attack. After about 20 minutes, the runway was cleared, and a man with colored flashlights motioned the lead aircraft into position. They were about to depart, and there was still no sign of the Polish army. I gave Roberto a sidelong look. He was biting his lip and fiddling with the safety catch on one of the Panzerfausts. And then, as the first aircraft began lumbering forward, like some great fat goose laboring to get up enough momentum to launch itself into the air, he handed his submachine gun to Maxine, moved to the lip of the runway, and took aim. The plane was still idling, though it would be a matter of seconds before it began its acceleration. When it passed us, Roberto would fire, and all manner of hell would let loose. I felt a sudden and violent urge to urinate, to vomit, to run, and the last of these I gave in to. I moved down the slope and into the woods, ignoring Maxine when she called after me. I ran, but not back toward the village. I ran up through the woods flanking the airstrip, clutching the heavy pistol, and feeling the sweat from my brow mix with the rain running down my face. I didn't know this part of the forest as well as I knew the trail, and had to be careful. But when I heard the pitch of the aircraft engine climb, I knew I didn't have much time. I emerged a few 100 yards down the runway, at the point where the slick concrete became gravel, then uneven grass and bracken. I looked down the concrete strip toward the lights, where the hulking plane was rocking forward, like it was towing something immense. Between me and the plane was the silent bulk of the Flakpanzer. There would be 4 men inside, but only the one in the AA turret
would be likely to hear me in the dark. I stared at the tank, not sure what I hoped to achieve, and I thought I heard a snatch of conversation from inside. For a moment, I tried to hear above the sound of the airplane's engines. It was all so strange, standing there in the night, a revolver in my hand, and the might of the Nazi army only feet away, oblivious. And then the plane picked up speed, and someone emerged from the darkness of the forest, shooting something squat from the crook of his arm. I couldn't see where the charge went, but it must have caught the fuselage of the Messerschmitt a glancing blow near the top, because there was a flash and a plume of orange, but the plane kept coming. As it outran the cloud of smoke, I could see in the floodlights where the roof behind the cockpit was scored with a ragged but superficial tear. Roberto had missed. Now the Flakpanzer came to life, creaking and groaning, as the gunner swung the turret round and opened fire with all four cannon, so that tracers flashed towards where the resistance fighters and Mrs. Habernicht crouched in the undergrowth. The sound was like bombs going off beside me, and the blaze from the muzzles, fire and lightning mixed, was blinding. Trees snapped and exploded, cut in half as the shells tore into them, and Roberto, the only one I could see, dropped under the raging hail of gunfire. I did not consciously decide to run at the tank or scale its hull, burning my hand on the exhaust pipe. I did not consciously choose to haul myself over the angled box of the turret sides. I do not believe I could have consciously shot the gunner down, but he saw me, and he let go of the cannon grips, snatching for his machine pistol. And I saw in his eyes what he meant to do. I saw anger and hatred, and maybe fear as well. Above all, I saw purpose, deliberation, the same kind of intent that had looked down the barrel of an MG-42 from a watchtower and cut my brother down. I pointed the revolver at his chest and fired. Just once. It was enough. I dropped the pistol, hand shaking, wondering vaguely if the men in the tank below me realized what had happened. As I paused, momentarily entranced by what I had done, the first gigantic Messerschmitt pulled up hard over the end of the runway and roared directly overhead, so that I ducked, hands over my face as it arced into the night. Despite Roberto, and however many of the others who were dead, and despite anything I had done, it escaped. But there were two more, one of them already on its way. The dead gunner was already half out of the seat, so with effort, I pulled him clear and took his place. Then I swiveled the turret a few degrees around, until I saw the nose of the second aircraft, just as its front wheels left the concrete, and I squeezed the trigger. The cannon shells raked the belly of the craft, and it juddered uncertainly, continuing to climb, but wounded now. I kept shooting, shouting incoherently, tears rolling down my cheeks, awash in grief and horror, and a terrible kind of joy I never want to feel again. The massive plane limped up into the night sky above me, but it was barely above the trees when it began to tip to one side, stalling, falling, and then the sky flared once more, and what was left of it plummeted into the woods. I stared vaguely toward where it had gone down, absently wiping the tears from my eyes, and realized that I had heard movement from below. The tank's belly hatch had opened. I snatched up the fallen machine pistol and peered over the canted walls of the turret. Three men scrambled out from beneath the tracks at the rear. One of them had an automatic pistol, and he rolled to his feet, sighting along the barrel at me. I saw the surprise in his face, the doubt when he registered the machine pistol, and then, without a word, he dropped the gun and raised his hands. I was too scared to trust him. My trigger finger twitched, but I took a breath. And in that moment, I saw that he was only a few years older than me. He looked pale, frightened, of me. On instinct,
I nodded toward the tree line and motioned with the gun. He and his fellows turned and ran into the darkness, not speaking or looking back, hands clasped behind their heads. I watched them go and got back into the gunner's seat. There was one more plane to come, but when I looked at the runway, it wasn't the Messerschmitt barreling towards me. It was the armored car, headlights blazing. My fingers felt thick as I fumbled for the trigger mechanism. In that split second, I felt the staccato thud and rattle of machine gun rounds kicking off the sides of the tank, as the armored car's weapons blazed. The shield around the AA mount buckled and popped, as two holes punched through, only inches from my shoulder. Stricken with terror, I dropped from the gunner's seat and hugged the decking as round after round punctured the pulpit and ripped through the air above me. The metal shredded and tore, lighting the darkness around me with a frightful brilliance matched by the deafening roar of the gun and the clanging of its shells. Overwhelmed, my senses fogged. I was too scared to weep and lay flat, eyes shut, waiting for death. And then there was another sound behind the others, a bang, deep and close and loud, after which there was a sudden silence, and the light changed, flaring red and yellow, the air stinking of oil and smoke. I waited for more cannon rounds to come streaming into the AA pulpit from the armored car. But as the stillness stretched on, second after agonizing second, I rolled cautiously onto my back and, very slowly, lifted my head just high enough that I could see through a hole torn by the cannon fire. I saw flame and movement, and I heard voices calling, and not in German. I sat up, peering over the savaged rim of the AA gun shield, my eyes prickling in the smoke. The armored car was burning, its turret crumpled impossibly. Behind it, hulking in the firelight, was a tank from which men were clamoring. I knew its shape from the secret broadsheets which had been smuggled round the ghetto, though I had never seen one. The distinctive sloping armor which had given the Nazis such an unwelcome shock on the fields of Kursk. It was a T-34, and now I could hear the voices of the troops as they rounded up the German survivors, and there could be no mistake. It was the Russians. 19. Katie, New Mexico, July 1947. Katie didn't mind the desert. It was weird, like another planet, but after the rubble they'd left behind thousands of miles away, she could see the bright side. The only thing that was hard was the language, and the way some of the kids at school looked at her. Her English was okay. Her father's was better. Perfect, it seemed to her. But then one of the boys in her class had told her the sign that had gone up in front of the house across from the playground that said, "Krauts go home," was supposed to be about her. The idea meant nothing to her at first, because she didn't understand it, even though the boy had whispered it under his breath without looking at her. His face flushed, which meant he thought it was true. She'd gone home and asked her father about it, and her father, who was good at explaining things, told her that some people around here didn't feel good about them being there, because this new country had been fighting Germany, their former country, for so long. Katie pointed out that that had all finished ages ago, but her father had smiled, in that way of his that showed he wasn't really happy, and said that it was only 2 years ago. 2 years seemed like a long time to Katie, her father said, but to grown-ups, it was no time at all. This was a worrying thought, all by itself, an idea as strange as the desert, where it never rained, and the birds and animals were unfamiliar. How could 2 years be no time at all? Was time as different here as its strange birds and lizards? Might she wake up tomorrow to find that a year had passed? What then? Would she grow old and weak, like the dark-skinned lady with the eagle face, who sold blankets and jewelry by the side of the road just outside town?
She lay awake, her knitted dolly with the yellow wool hair in her hands, wondering, studying the wristwatch that had belonged to her mother, staring at it without blinking to see if the hands moved faster than they ought to. If her mother was here, she would explain it. But her mother had been in Dresden when the bombers came. It was just Katie and her father now, alone in the desert, where time moved faster, and you didn't talk too much, in case people heard and figured out where you were from. Kraut. It was a nickname, her father said, from sauerkraut, but that didn't make sense. When Maggie Phillips said it, while they were lining up for assembly, Katie had explained, quite politely, she thought, that she didn't like sauerkraut and never ate it. Her mother used to make it for her father, she remembered. But you couldn't buy it in New Mexico, so even her father didn't eat it anymore. There were lots of things her father didn't have anymore. Perhaps that was why he seemed so sad. Of course, Katie knew that his sadness wasn't really about such things. Sauerkraut and forests, castles and beer, and the other things he talked about. But she was sure, in her heart, that if he could have them, he would feel better. Not about Dresden, though. There was nothing that would make him feel better about that, and she had learned that it was best not to try. She gazed at the ceiling one night, then told Hella, the yellow-haired doll, that she would speak to Mrs. Sims at the grocery store about ordering something her father would like. Not sauerkraut. Not beer. Some kind of sausage, perhaps. Her father liked sausage, the way they made it back home. There might be a way to get it. Pleased with the idea, she rolled onto her side, but had not fallen asleep when the phone rang. It rang for a long time, before she heard her father half falling out of bed and running heavily down the stairs, muttering to himself in German. He answered the phone in English, because that was what you had to do here, and then he went quiet for a while. When he spoke again, he sounded excited and a little confused, and it struck her as strange that he was speaking German again. She got out of bed, taking Hella with her, and moved on to the landing so she could see him through the banisters, pacing up and down the hall as he talked. He was smoking, and the cigarette in his hand seemed to tremble very slightly, as if his whole body were cold. He turned suddenly and looked up, as if he had been thinking of her, and she saw the strange look in his eyes. She wasn't sure what the expression meant, because she had never seen it before. He finished the conversation and said to her, in German, "Get dressed, little Katie. We have to go out." Katie stared at him, disbelieving. It was nighttime. She should be in bed. "I have to go out, and I can't leave you here alone," he replied. "You can bring Hella. Put on your dress and shoes." Katie left the house after dark for the first time since those late-night trips to the shelter 2 years ago, which it seemed so long ago, until she learned that time moved faster here. She asked where they were going, but her father just said, "Work," and hurried her into the car. Sometimes, when he wasn't too sad, they sang old songs in the car. But not tonight, perhaps because it was so late. She'd never been to her father's place of work, so she was surprised by how far it was. And she slept for part of the way, waking when someone shone a flashlight into the car and asked to see papers. It was a soldier with a gun and a helmet. Katie, who did not like soldiers, no matter what kind of uniform they were, kept very still and tried not to meet the man's eyes. It felt like her father was being tested, like at school when they showed you the words on a card and you had to read them in front of everyone in your best American English. But if so, it was a test he passed. They were allowed to drive into an area with a lot of square buildings, lit with lights on high stands. Dazzling lights that made the ground as bright and clear as lunchtime, though the sky above was black. Her father took her hand, She was surprised to note that his was sweaty, though the night was cool. He squeezed her fingers reassuringly, and she smiled at him to make him feel better. Pulling up beside their car where they'd parked was a pickup truck, its bed carrying a big, shiny balloon, made of something like the foil wrapped around chocolate bars. There was string, too, and some kind of big wooden box bound with pink tape that looked like it had been put together in someone's shed. Maybe it was a school project, a basket that you fastened to the balloon to see how high it would go, something like that. The driver looked to her father, then threw a shiny cover, big as a rug, over the back of the truck before driving off. Inside the building, there were more men in uniforms and more questions, some of them directed at her. No one seemed to know what to do with her, but her father explained, 5 or 6 times in his perfect English, that he could not leave her at home. She had to stay with him. "And anyway," he said, "who is she going to tell? She's a little girl, for God's sake." That meant he was serious. He did not say God unless he was very serious. Or sad. But they wouldn't let her in, so her father stopped her at the door. "I need you to wait here now, Katie," her father had said, glancing over his shoulder, as if there was something there he desperately wanted to see. "Just for a few minutes." "I want to see," she said. "Maybe later," he replied. "But for now, you must be patient and not come in. Is that clear?"
"Yes, father," she said, not happily.
She turned away and began to walk in the direction he had nodded. But as she heard the door behind her open, she turned and looked after him. Her father was showing his papers again, while other people took flash photographs and whispered to each other. The room beyond the door was so big that it wasn't really a room at all, more like a space with walls and a roof big as a football field, maybe bigger. In the middle, under multiple floodlights, more men stood with guns, guarding a strange metal object that flashed under the lights. It was big, like a giant's cake pan that had rolled off his table and landed upside down, and part of it was broken. She stared past the soldiers and the men in white coats, but then the door closed again, and she was alone. It seemed like he was gone a long time, though she couldn't be sure because of the way the time ran differently in the desert. Her feet got tired from standing, and she sat down on the chilly concrete. Once he came to check on her, his face still pink and shiny with strange emotions. And someone gave her a chair. And that was all she remembered. She woke up in the car, a mile from home. The sky was still dark, and her father was very quiet and thoughtful, but not sad, not angry. When they reached their driveway, he turned off the engine and sat staring at his hands on the steering wheel, not looking at her, unaware that she was awake. When she spoke, he jumped and looked surprised. Then he took her in his arms and carried her inside. He clutched her tight to him as they walked, so that Katie, a little frightened by his love, asked nothing about where they had been or why. When they were in her room and she was sitting on her bed, he hesitated in the doorway, looking at her. "No piano lesson for you tomorrow," he said. "Get into bed."
"But I have to go to my lesson," said Katie. "The teacher says so."
"I will speak to the teacher, little Katie," he said. "You have had a very tiring night, and you need your sleep."
"I don't want to," she said. "I'm not sleepy."
She was, but she didn't want to say so. She didn't want him to leave. His peculiar excitement, the place with the soldiers, and the cake pan all made her feel strange. And she didn't want to be left alone in the dark, though she couldn't think of how to say so. "I'll sit with you," he said. "And look, I brought you a present." She snuggled under the thin blanket, face open and attentive to what she was going to get. From his pocket, he drew what she first thought was a candy wrapper. It was balled up tight, a little screw of paper, so that her excitement at being given a present disappeared, and she gave him a crestfallen look. As she did, he opened his hand, and something remarkable happened. The patch of foil sprang open and went perfectly flat, showing not so much as a wrinkle in its surface. Katie gasped, delighted, and put out her hand to receive it. Her father gave her the thin piece of foil, and she gasped again as it pulsed with a soft blue radiance that spangled like water. It gave off enough light that she could see her father's eyes in the darkness. He reached out cautiously and touched his hand to hers, whereupon the bluish glow became pink as dawn. He let go, watching the light change back to blue, and his face was unreadable once more. Days later, after she had gone back to school, the schoolyard was abuzz about a crash. The newspaper showed the men in uniform with what they called the recovered debris. It was a weather balloon, the paper explained. It looked like the bits of wood and foil she'd glimpsed in the back of the pickup truck. Her father told her she wasn't supposed to say anything about it, and that she should forget, because the crash was not something worth remembering. But Katie remembered, and if she ever felt herself doubting what she had seen, she would take out the piece of strange metal foil that glowed when she touched it with her skin. And she would remember the look in her father's face, a mixture of delight and anxiety, confusion and horror.
20. Allen, Dreamland, Nevada. They didn't call it 51, not the people who worked there. They called it, appropriately enough, Dreamland. It was a maze of blank corridors and windowless rooms, every door fitted with combination locks and badge-reading scanners. Armed guards stood at every corner and did not speak, such that Allen sometimes got the impression he was the only real person there. The truth was that they were just people who knew and did their jobs, unfazed by the strangeness of the place. Posters on every other wall read, "If you see something odd, don't wait. Report it." That ought to keep everyone busy, Allen thought. Allen had been there a week, but for all its otherworldly interiors and the desolate exterior landscape, nothing so far had matched the excitement of that first 5 minutes. He still didn't know what exactly he had seen. His questions had been met with a disinterested silence. His glimpse of the ship had been little more than the reward he'd needed for resigning his commission as a Marine. That done, he'd immersed himself in a world of books and computer tutorials so abstract in their applications that half the time he didn't know if he was learning to fly a plane or operate a high-tech washing machine. He read passages and filled out questionnaires, but there was frequently no clear relationship between the two, and often nothing about planes or flying at all. By the third day, he began to suspect it was all a test or a bad joke at his expense, and that none of it really meant anything at all. The fourth and fifth days he spent in a completely unremarkable classroom, with a guard on the door armed with a purposeful-looking M4 carbine. He studied logs and tables, charts and diagrams, and from time to time, an instructor who did not give his name came in to talk him through the next pages, speaking in a steady monotone. Allen took multiple-choice tests late into the night, after which he was escorted to his quarters to sleep, until it all began again the next day. He hadn't known what to expect, but the boredom surprised him. That was as much irony as Dreamland was going to give him. Though he saw several other men undergoing similar instruction, he talked to no one but his instructors, who merely gave him lists of the day's tasks and took his written work in without comment. He didn't even know if they read it.
The base was owned and operated by the Air Force, but it was compartmentalized and spread over a large area in separate units between which there was no traffic. While he occasionally glimpsed jets in the sky over to the northwest, he interacted with no Air Force personnel at all. The base guards were a separate security force, and everyone else was CIA. Hatcher met him for dinner every night, but kept the talk small, sports mainly, and barbecue. Hatcher was a nut for barbecue. "No politics, religion, or military intel," he said, the first time they sat down together. Alan abided by the rules for as long as he could, until one night he had to ask. "That craft we saw when I first arrived," he asked Hatcher. "What was it?" They were eating dinner, just the two of them, in a canteen the size of a warehouse. Lobster and filet mignon, flown in from Vegas. "You want to know if it was a flying saucer?" Hatcher clarified. Alan had been avoiding the term, even in his own mind. It was too loaded with impossible things, with craziness and zealotry. The problem was that the term fit all too well. The craft had been roughly saucer-shaped, 20 feet across, and windowless. It was bare metal, like brushed nickel or aluminum, and showed no lights, except a large central one on the underside, which seemed to be its source of propulsion. The disc bulged upwards in the middle, but was otherwise unmarked, so it was impossible to be sure if it was rotating or not. And it was flying, though not in any way Alan could recognize or make sense of. He said nothing, pretending to be too busy chewing to answer directly, though Hatcher, who recognized the moment for what it was, just smiled. "Yes," he said simply, "it was a flying saucer." "So that means it's..." He reached for a word, one perhaps even more insane than flying saucer. "Alien?" he said at last. Alan wasn't sure what he had expected from Hatcher, but the CIA man's laugh, which in other circumstances might have been scornfully dismissive, came as a welcome relief. "Made in the USA," he said, "by people like you and me." "But how?" said Alan. "I've been in aviation all my adult life, and I've never even heard of anything that looked or moved like that." Hatcher grinned. "Because it's secret, Alan." He didn't say it, but dumbass was implied. "Okay," said Alan. "Why?" "It's how we keep our edge," said Hatcher. "And this is a test facility. The R&D section here, a subdivision of a major commercial aerospace manufacturer, whose sole client is the U.S. government, is called Possum Plant. Ask me why." "Why?" "Because they are really good at playing dead when people get too close. These are secret machines, Alan, but they are ours." "So why not show the world we have them, and stop any potential enemies in their tracks?" "Like I said," answered Hatcher, spearing a hunk of steak with his fork, "we are a test facility. You know how long it took to get the U-2 operational? Or the Blackbird? Wouldn't make sense to show our hand to the world before we had everything in working order, would it?" "But I saw one of these things in Afghanistan," said Alan. "That's why I'm here. You took a chance on me because I'd already seen one. And because you're a damn fine pilot," said Hatcher. "But my point," Alan pressed on, refusing to be deflected by the compliment, "is that one of those ships showed up and interfered with my mission, right?" Hatcher considered whether or not to answer this before nodding. "It would seem so," he said. "So someone else has, whatever the hell those ships are, yeah? Someone other than the ordinary people of the USA who built the one I saw last week." "We're entering classified territory again," said Hatcher, putting down his knife and fork. "You're telling me a bunch of Afghan insurgents have access to aviation technology so advanced that our own country doesn't know it exists?" "Of course not," said Hatcher. "So?" "So, think it through." Alan frowned. "Someone else is supplying them, or interceding on their behalf?" Hatcher didn't deny it, returning his gaze to his plate,
and continuing his meal in silence.
"But who would have that kind of tech?"
Hatcher said nothing.
"They would also have an interest in either destabilizing the region," Alan continued, thinking aloud, "or of undermining U.S. interests in the area."
Still, Hatcher said nothing.
"And the technology the ground team at Safed Co. wanted to recover was connected to the development of these same craft, or you wouldn't have brought Murat out here with me."
"Which means we're in some kind of secret arms race."
At last, Hatcher spoke.
"You haven't figured out who we're dealing with, but you've answered your first question."
"Which was?"
"Why are we keeping the program secret?" "Because we aren't the only ones involved. Secrecy, like information, is currency. It's power, and it has to be protected at all costs. All arms races are secret, until they're not."
Alan digested this.
"The Russians," he said. "It has to be. Or the Chinese."
"You have room for dessert?" said Hatcher, as if they'd been discussing the weather. "The chef does an excellent creme brulee." Alan opened his mouth to say more, but the CIA man raised one index finger, eyes on his plate. The conversation was over. Dreamland was quiet at night, so quiet that Alan